Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 107. Have you ever thought to yourself, well, of course we want to do data science, but we are but a 120-year-old aluminum company or something, and no one here has even contemplated the invalidity of the pie chart, much less the inner workings of centralized code repositories for commonly used R snippets. But that's what this episode is about, not just data science, but data science at the enterprise level. And in the next 40 or so minutes, we will slightly be more useful than all those Watson commercials you've seen on TV. I used a predictive algorithm to arrive at that conclusion. Hey, Mo, have you ever worked at a company like that I was talking about?
Just a little bit. Some growing pains for sure.
Oh, okay. And Tim, I believe you were the first person in the world who recognized the invalidity of the pie chart. Is that correct?
As long as nobody tries to Google that, we'll go with it.
Okay. And I'm Michael Helbling, as someone who thinks about data science, but is content to let others actually do it. But to really get this conversation over that IBM Watson hump, we needed a guest, someone who could bring some real perspective to the enterprise application of data science. And so we found our guest, Katie Sasso. She is a data scientist at the Columbus Collaboratory. She's the organizer of the Our Ladies Columbus Meetup and is also one of the planners of the Women in Analytics Conference. She has her PhD from The Ohio State University in Experimental Psychology, and we are pleased to have her on our show as our guest. Welcome to the show, Katie.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, we are too. So I think one thing to get us kicked off would be great is just to get a little better understanding. I mean, the word data science and data scientist gets thrown around a lot, but so maybe just give folks a sense for your day-to-day, what you do at the Columbus Collaboratory.
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, I'm a data scientist at the Collaboratory, and day-to-day, I do a variety of different things. So typically from a data science development perspective, I'm usually working full-time on about two projects. And at the Collaboratory, we try to time box those a bit. So it varies, but on average, they're about 6 to 8 weeks in length. And so on a typical day, I'm doing kind of a mix of meetings with clients to review kind of goals and targets and interim deliverables for those projects. I'll be doing a lot of programming in R as well for those projects. And then more recently, I've started to have kind of a heavier hand in scoping new projects and bringing those in. And I've also started to run some things we're calling workshops. So those are basically half day kind of use case discovery sessions. So it's growing to be kind of a mix of all of those activities. But say, I'd say on the typical day, it's meetings, it's programming in R, and it's kind of talking with clients and figuring out what is going to be best for helping them answer the question or improve the process that they're focused on.
So just as you're referring to your clients, can you maybe give the quick rundown on kind of what the Columbus Collaboratory is and how it works? Because that's kind of, it's unique and interesting. And I think your clients are literally different enterprises, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the Collaboratory, we are kind of considered a startup, but in a lot of ways, we're not like a startup at all. So we were founded about 4 years ago by seven major non-competing companies in Columbus. So those include AEP, Battelle, Cardinal Health, Huntington Bank, L Brands, Nationwide Insurance, and Ohio Health. So seven companies in completely different industries. And kind of the goal, our charter was basically to focus on, you know, kind of bringing these seven companies together and building each other up and also the Columbus area, specifically in advanced analytics and cybersecurity, and then also the intersection of those two. So kind of the long-term plan was, you know, let's harness the power of that kind of the collective here of these seven non-competing companies to improve one another. And then eventually let's go out into the marketplace and start to sell our services and products in a way that can kind of just move the area forward in these kind of two paths and also their intersection. So my clients for the past kind of 2 years have been folks at these large companies, but then more recently, we've also started started to take on external clients.
And so how exactly is your team structured? Or is it more that kind of every person in the team works for different clients? Or how exactly is it structured work-wise?
Yeah, good question. So I think what we really try to do is keep things fresh and interesting for all of our developers and practitioners. So typically, you know, how you decide what project you're working on as a data scientist is a combination of your expertise and your skill set. And then also kind of capacity too is something we factor in. But the goal is, you know, to keep things fresh such that you're not working on the same project for years and years, which was really exciting to me when I started. So basically, you know, we have projects, you can kind of view them as coming in from all parts of the business. And then this past year, we started to focus a little bit more into certain areas. So of course, cybersecurity and applying advanced analytics there. The IT space kind of naturally falls out of that. And then we've done work across all different areas, but we've kind of built up a great collection of work broadly in areas of kind of risk and finance. So just depending on where there's demand from members and where we see opportunities, that'll be kind of the content of the project that falls kind of on your lap or in the queue.
So my impression is that some of the enterprise clients I work with, they really don't have any in-house data science, and kind of to Michael's joke at the, you know, beginning, they're still struggling with, you know, they don't even have a BI tool, you know, they're barely doing stuff in Excel. Other enterprises have a data science team, but for whatever reason, it's kind of off it's kind of the scope of what they work on. There's a boundary drawn around it somewhere, even though from a high level, you'd say, well, there are probably all sorts of other areas of the enterprise that can use it. What is driving the need or the recognition that, hey, we can use this pseudo outsourced? I mean, you're effectively an external consultant, even if you're kind of known and therefore presumably kind of blessed from kind of a data access and NDA and all that sort of stuff. Like, what's, is it we're not doing any of this stuff, or we just don't have the capacity? Like, what makes them sort of stand up and say, hey, this would be a good 6 to 8 week sprint of a project for you guys to work on?
So I'd say it varies quite a bit. So I'd say within all of our members, so those are, you know, pretty large companies, within all of them, there is some sort of analytics function somewhere. So I'd say it's not the case that, you know, none of them have, you know, any expertise in analytics. I'd say quite the opposite. Some of them have very advanced expertise in analytics, and others have, you know, expertise in their, you know, kind of more specific domain of, you know, problems that they see come across that are more industry specific. So I'd say to answer your question for members, it kind of varies in terms of how or why they come to us for a problem. So I'd say certainly for cybersecurity, that is probably the main area where I'd say the members might look to us as having kind of this expertise or skill set that perhaps might be harder to find in-house. So that would be one reason I think they come to us on the cyber side. And cyber projects look all sorts of ways. So it can be anything from trying to detect insider threat or trying to, you know, basically detect attacks, you know, early in the stages of them happening rather than reacting to them. And all sorts of other different things in the kind of the IT and cyberspace are things that folks might turn to us for because they feel like we have, you know, an expertise built up in that area, which is, you know, definitely the case. I'd say in other areas, oftentimes folks will come to us because they might have the expertise, but maybe they don't have the capacity. Or maybe it's a risky project that, you know, they have a you know, highly skilled analytics team, but maybe this project has kind of an uncertain ROI on it and they want us to move quick to just kind of prove out value. And then they might decide to take it from there and run with it. Or maybe they want us to work on it. And then I'd say the other, you know, so it's kind of expertise, capacity needs. And then I'd say kind of the third bucket sometimes are maybe folks within the enterprise who don't actually typically have access to the analytics team. So it's kind of a combination of, in that case, I guess, expertise and, you know, lack of availability, you know, so there's this kind of internal prioritization typically in a lot of these companies and a lot of demands on where the analytics team spends their time. So for those folks, I'd say, you know, if they're maybe in a totally different silo of the business, like a call center or HR, they might have access to somebody who does kind of really lightweight reporting like Tableau dashboards, but it might be much harder for them to get resources that fall more in the predictive modeling domain. So that's probably the third big bucket. And then I think in the marketplace for us turning to external clients, that's been kind of, we've seen a mix of kind of all those different needs, right? So I think there's some folks that are really looking at us to be the experts. They don't have folks in-house. And I'd say there's also been a lot of interest for folks who maybe do have quite a practice in-house, but they want a team that's going to be able to move quickly and ship them an R package and kind of the rawest form, and then their team will take it and run with it. So hopefully that helps a bit.
That's interesting. There's so much demand for these internal resources. We know we'd like to try it as well, but we're not going to be able to make that case internally. That thinking about it from a, if there's an analyst, using me as the example of an analyst who's trying to learn aspects of data science. Now, I'm not inside an enterprise, but if I was inside an enterprise, it seems like there's the opportunity to say, look, we're probably never going to bubble up on the data science team's radar. We're going to struggle to get those resources, but you know, we can maybe tap into them a little bit, not like circumvent them, just say it's an opportunity for the traditional analyst who has now learned R, has been digging into modeling, to say, let's try this out. Now, they don't have the necessary, that's not a way to have the safety blanket of the actual knowledge, expertise, experience to do it, but it's just what you're making me think of, that those pockets where the call center, say, never has had really kind of advanced sort of analytics work being done. And it's an opportunity to say, we know our data, we know our problems. We just need to slot in and see if we can prove out without necessarily staffing up a full team, presumably, right?
And I think one of the like offerings we've started to develop in the past year or so has been this idea of these like half day use case discovery workshops. So we might actually go into a team like the one you just described, where they know their data, they know their processes, and they know where they want to be, but they're just not, you know, perhaps they don't have the, you know, hard technical resources in all the areas, or even the time to get there to build that more of that predictive modeling solution. So we'll come in there and we'll, you know, kind of lay out a roadmap of different analytics use cases. And then it's really nice because it's kind of up to them to say, you know, maybe we want to engage the collaboratory on this use case. Maybe we can, you know, go in-house and see if our internal enterprise analytics team can handle this one. So those have been kind of nice ways of kind of showing what's possible and then arming them with the information to say, hey, here's how we want to tackle these.
Yeah. When you mentioned the half day stuff, I was like, I want to come back to that. So I'm glad you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to turn a little bit and ask your thoughts on a situation. Actually, over the break, it was really funny. Clearly have too much free time because a bunch of data nerd people in Sydney got together to hang out and just talk about data nerd problems. But suffice to say, we were all talking about the issue of data scientists nowadays. They're often getting tasked with like building dashboards and reporting. And, you know, the way that a data scientist often does good work is to kind of be left alone with a problem for 2 months and to have time to build something and iterate. And that doesn't often happen in the business context. I'm just curious to hear, how are you able to manage that because of the structure? Or do you think you're doing something inherently different that's giving you you and the team you work with the time to actually tackle those big problems?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think we've definitely, you know, I've definitely encountered kind of the desire for, you know, the dashboard and I think it's maybe not, you know, that folks are just like, I just want a dashboard, but I think there's something that you can touch and feel about something like a dashboard, something very tangible. So I think that's definitely, you know, come up, right? And that's a pitfall. I think the way to kind of guard against that is maybe something I think that our team kind of collectively in our process has done a really good job of hardening up. And I think really that is, you know, taking the time in the scoping phase to, you know, really identify the question or the set of questions you're trying to answer and trying to get the user to focus on those as opposed to the tool. So, you know, it may not be the case that, you know, a convolutional neural net's the best approach to your problem. Maybe a nice little logistic regression will work, you know, depending on what the use case is. So I think we try to get the user to focus on their question and the processes, and we try to kind of give them the visibility into why we select the algorithms we do if they're interested. So that's the one big thing, is focusing on the question and then picking apart, asking really specific questions about the process that might underpin that question they're trying to address, or that aspect they're trying to improve on. So that's one thing. And I think the other thing that I've really learned from my coworkers as well is the huge importance of knowing who your end user is and what that looks like. So is your end user, you know, in the case of a company like L Brands, who owns Victoria's Secrets, is the end user going to be me, somebody shopping online who's going to see an ad, right? Or in a totally different context, maybe your end user is internal. Maybe I'm talking to the end user and they're using this application to detect insider threat for cybersecurity. So it's really important at the end of the day to know your end user. And depending on who your end user is, I think that is going to dictate the importance of something like a tangible dashboard that can really translate the results of maybe a very sophisticated statistical model versus if your end user is maybe more of a data practitioner, they don't want that at all. They just want you to build a package in R and give that to them maybe. And that will help them move quicker. So I think those are the two big things, is kind of knowing your question, knowing the data and the processes that underpin it, and then knowing who your end user is. And you'll still get some of that pushback sometimes in terms of folks just focused on the AI solution or magic button or the dashboard they want. But I've found, you know, that most folks are pretty smart if you kind of work with them to help them understand their problem and our process, that they'll be pretty receptive to kind of opening up to different solutions and what a different end product might look like.
So on that, as you like the workshops, whether it was a formal workshop or whether it was really just kind of the discovery, how do you balance there's understanding the problem, but then presumably you have to understand what data might be available? It seems like it'd be easy to get sucked down into talking about a convolutional neural network versus logistic regression in the discovery to make sure that the use case or the problem matches the data, matches some approach. And how do you kind of, is there a tendency to get sucked down into the solutioning when you're trying to kind of brainstorm around problems? Or
so I'd say typically in a workshop, like those sorts of technical details don't typically come up. I will say, you know, I definitely have experienced before, like kind of a focus on the solution versus understanding what the use cases are. So that's where, you know, kind of that walking through what the process is. Hey, this is really about pulling out analytics use cases that are going to be of the highest value to you. And then we'll kind of give you our best ideas of what those potential solutions might be to answering those questions. So one thing I try to do before these is I try to get a sense. It's hard because the whole point of the workshop is to figure out what use cases you have. But depending on the space, you know, if you know it's an IT service desk or maybe a marketing department or a call center, you know roughly the type of problems they have. So there's a bit of pre-work involved. And then typically I'll try to get a sense of what data they have ahead of time. And kind of the most important piece is finding somebody who really understands and owns that data and making sure they're present at the workshop as well as somebody who knows the process. So typically, if I can get a sense of that ahead of time, I'll at least know, hey, there's absolutely no data here to address this question. Or I'll know like, oh, there might be kind of a sparse number of records for this type of question. I think I have to really pull out what they're looking for here and, you know, kind of look through it of the lens of is this possible? And then I'll often do some follow-up work to kind of actually pull in their data, see how many records they are, see if data sets even join to one another before I tell them, hey, go after this use case where really they don't have the data for it and the data doesn't pair up. But yeah, it's definitely happened before where folks are kind of interested in a specific end solution. But I found that I think with the appropriate prep work ahead of time and the appropriate conversations, that they're more than receptive to finding the right solution. But it, you know, there is that kind of conversation up front, I think, to get everybody on that page.
So I'm no data scientist, but you were sounding like you were describing some of the first couple of steps of the CRISP-DM methodology. Do you guys follow the CRISP? Are you familiar with the CRISP-DM? This is me like reading just enough to be dangerous, but it's like business understanding and then data understanding.
I'm not. I don't know the article you're talking about. Actually, episode
108 is totally going to be you trying to help us with our relationship as podcast co-host. So I guess that's good to like you say. I think I have that initial piece. Forget the methodology. I've just talked to one too many. I've heard it one too many times and thought everybody does this. And I was going to sound cool. And instead I sound like a hack, But that's so. But to play that back, you were saying you'd say this. You have some familiarity of the problem beforehand, or possible problems, and the data. When you say this use case feels pretty good, let's do a little bit of exploration of the data to make sure, because it just in case you don't have, if somebody's not as knowledgeable as they think they are about the data, they may say, oh yeah, we have all historical data going back, you know, and it's super easy to access. And then it turns out that it's, you know, flat file stored on tape in Iron Mountain.
Yes. So, yeah. So that's, I think that's part of the prep work too, as I say, like broadly what data is going to be of use here. And then, you know, when I get the attendee list, I walk through and I try to say, hey, is this the person who knows, you know, this database? Is this the person who knows your, you know, I don't know, your marketing data? It would be more specific than that. And, you know, they say, yeah, I think so. And then I try to actually give whoever I'm scheduling this with, which is often somebody who's more in leadership, I give them specific examples of questions I hope this person could answer. Like, So would they be able to tell me if these are audio recordings or transcripts? Would they be able to tell me if your, you know, HR employee data matches up to this IT data? Would they be able to tell me that sort of information? And if the answer is, gee, I don't know, well, then I schedule a call with the person who we think knows. And if they don't know, I try to find the person who does. Yeah.
Damn, you're really good. Like everything you say, I'm like, man, that's great plan. Great. So okay, on that though, what happens when you do get into the process and the data doesn't actually look like kind of what you anticipated, or there's, you know, or it's just a really shitty data set that's, you know, got heaps of missing values? Like how do you tackle it when you go in thinking one thing and along the way you're like, whoa, this is going to blow out by a month?
Right. So usually a quick litmus test is okay for kind of knowing, hey, I think we'll be able to generate something useful. It might not be, you know, we might be getting you like a, I don't know, Toyota Camry versus like a BMW, but I think we'll be able to get you a car, you know, some mode of transportation. Usually a quick litmus test of me looking at the data can tell me that much. And I think most of that actually just comes from experience being a practitioner in data science and kind of knowing what you need to build a certain type of model or answer a certain type of question. I'd say actually one kind of, from a data perspective, I'd say one of the bigger kind of black holes that I think is kind of hard to know till you really do more than a rudimentary pass is text data. So sometimes folks might have an idea that text data is really useful. It's got all these useful insights. And then you get in and, you know, it takes a few hours of work to get to the point where you're like, this is garbage. People are just saying the same thing over and over again. You know, people drag and drop, copy and paste. You know, if there's 10 records, sure, that's easy to spot. But if there's 10,000, you're going to have to do some processing to get to that point. So I'd say those are the typical black holes where a quick litmus test is not going to be good. You know, if you pull in the file, you can do a quick kind of read on table on how many missing values you have. That's going to be easy to detect. You get a quick sense of the number of records, how far back in time they go, if they link to one another. But things like the quality of certain fields and what predictive weight they're going to hold, those typically take more than just, you know, an hour or two of looking and pulling the data into R or whatever you're using.
Where are you actually typically working with the data? I mean, given you've got cybersecurity as another focus, like it seems like, okay, we've got a use case. Now give me a sample of the data. Or, I mean, are you having to typically work through VPN and keep the data in-house? Are you able to pull the data somewhere else? How do you have to, and I'm thinking again, like if I'm noodling around with it inside at a company, I'm still going to have to probably put the data somewhere, and I'm probably not going to get IT to necessarily stand up an environment for me.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think hats are off to the collaboratory DevOps team who does a ton of work. But basically, I'd say when I'm doing development work, I'm like never on my own computer. I'm always on a VM somewhere. So it kind of varies. At the majority of our member companies, we actually have hardware that sits behind their firewall. So super secure. You basically, there's one way in and one way out. So the data never leaves their premises, actually. So that's really cool. Obviously, a huge investment to stand up those environments. I'd say on the other hand, if it's somebody who's kind of a newer client, or depending on the circumstances, we might discuss if setting up an environment like that is something they have the appetite for. But typically it's something like an SFTP transfer that our team will set up for them so they can securely get us data. And oftentimes, you know, use cases don't require PII usually. It depends.
Do you sometimes need a partner on their end though to actually do the scrubbing or the hashing to make sure that what they're sending to you is compliant with whatever they need? Or
yeah, so we will help okay. You know, if they need that sort of help. Typically there's somebody on their side who's capable of doing that, so we'll just set up that SFTP transfer for them. We'll send them the information, but then on our side we do almost always work within a VM. So we call them stacks. The collaboratory has its own kind of set of hardware. So typically we'll have a VM set up, you know, either per data scientist or per project. So it's pretty rare that I'm doing anything on my laptop, like our studio desktop. Usually if I do, it's like tinkering or simulated data, just to make sure I can hand off something to somebody.
So ballpark, I'm just like curious, what's the ratio of kind of DevOps to data scientists? Like how many DevOps does it take to support? And maybe that's not even a meaningless question.
No, that's a good question. I mean, our DevOps guys work super hard. When I started, which is, goodness, I guess 2 years ago now, when I started, there were basically two, you know, kind of our head of data science, and then there was our senior data scientist who was doing more of the scoping, bringing in projects. But basically, there were kind of three core developers, data science developers, one with a lot of software expertise. And then as we've grown, at this point, we have 5 to 6 data scientists. Some are part-time transitioning from PhD programs. And at this point, DevOps is, they are currently, 3 kind of full-time folks, but I think we kind of, you know, they might be expanding in the future as we expand. So I'd say it's even though it sounds like it's not one-to-one, it's close-ish because some of our data scientists are part-time. But so I'd say it's kind of trailed back and forth in terms of being matched versus there being a few more data scientists.
I feel like the data science, it's not hard to stumble into where all of a sudden you're trying to deal with AWS or Google Cloud Platform. And I have definitely lost hours I don't want to get back, where I was trying to read step-by-step posts to do something in the cloud and thinking, man, I wish there was a DevOps person. I just wonder what, I guess if you're in-house at a company, potentially you could say, you know, I'm doing kind of a proof of concept. Let me get small enough data, scrubbed enough data within the company's policies to put it somewhere. But as soon as you have it locally on your laptop or your desktop, your chances are somebody's going to get really, really squeamish. So I guess maybe if the company just has the ability to set up VMs and you can say, look, that's what I'll work off of. I don't know. That sounds like kind of a blocker that's, can be unfortunate if you need that skill.
They're just different, really. So, you know, there might be a package in R that I have no problem getting on like the OS on my Mac, you know, this Linux-based back OS. But if I'm working in CentOS or Red Hat on a stack, it's a different process for installing that package. So I think there was kind of a growing curve for us as data scientist practitioners to learn that. And then I'd say hats off to kind of the DevOps team for continually involving these environments to make them easier and easier for us to work on. So it kind of takes, I think, on both ends, from the data scientist and the DevOps team. I feel like we both kind of go out of our comfort zone a little bit to, you know, we take on some maybe more DevOps type skills than a data scientist would maybe at a huge company where they don't touch that. And they probably know a little bit more about R than they expected to know. but, you know, overall, I'd say it's not it's never reached the point where we can't do our work by any means. So, and I think a lot of that has been like good communication between the two teams in terms of what's working and what needs to be improved.
So you mentioned that you have a lot of people coming kind of straight from PhDs to work with you. I'm curious to hear, it sounds like you have incredible people skills and like stakeholder management, but I assume that everyone starting wouldn't kind of, you know, walk in with all of that knowledge and experience. So how do you as a team manage, I guess, development of that sort of stuff? Like, do you buddy people up, or do you just kind of like, did the newer staff learn on the fly?
Yeah. So it's kind of evolved over time as we've grown. So I've been there 2 years. And when I started, there were three of us. It probably wasn't until the past, I'd say this past year is when we've grown from like three to six. So I think we kind of all have a mix of different skill sets. And to this point, I think our team has been small enough such that we naturally kind of partner and communicate on our different skill sets, you know, what somebody's strength is versus not. So I'd say very much there's somebody on our team who I kind of consider like the technical Sherpa from a statistics standpoint. Like if somebody gets a new problem and they really want to go into, you know, building their own model from the equation or matrix level, you know, there's kind of one to two guys who you consult with on that. There's folks who kind of own more of the client management. So that's something that I've started to do a bit. And then we also have one of our data scientists who's just like an expert in software and all things internet. So he's who you'd go to with for those questions. But I think as we grow, we'll probably have to formalize that a bit. Right now, it just kind of works. We just all talk to one another. But as we get larger, we might have to think through how that plays out in a more formal way.
So I guess I've got a question around sort of the time horizon that companies should be using. So if you're a large company, then there's a lot of things happening kind of, you know, sometimes it's harder to turn a ship than a motorboat kind of a concept. But what kind of time horizon should companies kind of realistically expect, in other words, in problems to work on with data science initiatives? So in other words, there's a lot of today problems, right? Our email marketing isn't producing enough results, but there's a lot of tomorrow problems, like how we solve some of the talent gap that's going to happen in the next 20 years. So like, where do companies, how close to today can they work, and how far out into the future should they be sort of looking and thinking? So if I've got a bunch of data problems that I want to bring as an enterprise organization, what's my horizon look like? Or what have you observed, I guess, is more what I'm looking for.
That's a good question. So you're kind of asking you're not asking like basically how long should I expect a solution take to be built, but you're more asking, you know, what solution do I focus on? The thing that's going to solve the fire that's currently burning, or going to put out the fire in 2 years?
You got to look at it from both sides, right? So there's one that is sort of like, I've got these burning problems and I'd love to solve them right now. But there's also a reality of, well, it takes a little bit longer than like 30 minutes to build appropriate model, test it, validate it, and actually give you back something that's going to drive value against that particular problem set. So that's kind of it's that intersection. And so, you know, do we tell businesses, hey, listen, we want to help you solve like your major issue that you came to us about, but actually we need to look at it from this window or from this perspective, because there's this sense of expectation. And yeah, you could go further out and say, but I mean, most businesses are like, we want to do one-to-one personalized marketing tomorrow. And it's like, well, that doesn't happen. That's just not how it works. So let's talk about how we stepwise get you there.
So I think you kind of answered it a bit, I guess, with that last piece, right?
Well, no, but I mean, I was hoping you could be like, here's my perspective on
what I've seen. That's totally how we do it, though. I mean, if somebody is, I think this gets back, this is kind of baked into what I said about like finding the right question. So this to me is part of that like pre-scoping process where you're trying to figure out, somebody might come to you with a question of, hey, you know, we want to boost revenue from our ads 200%, right? So that's not going to help me from a data science perspective. I need to chip away at the core pieces that make up that up. And one of them might be starting at the point of, well, how much revenue are you attributing to your ads today? And where did this number even come from? And let's get better and sharper at kind of measuring, you know, what credit you're taking from your ads, and maybe sometimes even like, what is the outcome you should be attributing to the success of your ads? Maybe it's not revenue. Maybe it's people buying more units or people buying different products. So I think that's kind of part of how we solve that, is in this finding the right question piece. And I think for the most part, folks come to us with, I hate to say it, but kind of like high value return questions. And those tend to be a mix of something we could be doing better today, and also something we know that long term is going to continue to be a process, continue to be a question we're answering. And we might have something in place to address it now, but we feel like it could be better because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And I was just curious, like, how often you feel like you have to temper expectations as opposed to in that regard as well. Because sometimes that's a piece of it is sort of people come in, they're like, here's all my data and problems. Go make the magic data science happen. And then you kind of have to start rebuilding people's concepts of sort of what's possible.
Yeah, that definitely happens quite a bit. I'd say it's still probably the minority. I think most folks understand this as a process, but I definitely encounter that. And I think usually when you walk through kind of a concrete example of what this is going to look like, usually folks are receptive to that. But I mean, sometimes it is the case that there's this illusion that it's going to be really quick and everything's going to just solve, you know, the world's problems. But I'd say most often, if it's a complicated problem, most folks on the other side of the table recognize, like, hey, we're not perfect at this. So this must be a challenging problem to address. But yeah, that definitely does happen. And I think that's where you kind of got to pare back the possibility of what you're trying to answer.
Oh, that's cool. And then I guess another question that's been brewing, sorry to take two at a time, but Tim's talked a lot. So obviously my experience is more on the marketing side of things, digital analytics. And so in that world, we're really dealing with two kinds of data that's typically sort of descriptive data and then sort of behavioral or transactional data. And I'm curious, do you run into other types of data that in other areas and other, you know, in other venues? I'm just not familiar enough with other practices of analytics. So like descriptive data, sort of like the stuff you get from like third party places is like a soccer mom who drives an Audi TT. And then the behavioral data is sort of like they bought from us three times last year, or they visited our mobile website, you know, last Monday, that kind of stuff. I'm just curious, like, because you go into other areas of analytics. I'm just curious, are there other areas of data that people should be aware of?
Yeah, so there's a world of other data. I'd say actually, though, what's interesting, though, is and I can give you examples, but seemingly unrelated data, often from a statistics standpoint, can have a similar approach be applied to solve a similar type of question, like classification, for example. So like,
sure,
what's an informative predictor could look totally different, but I still could have the same model be the best solution for the problem. So I'd say data can look all sorts of ways different than that. So a lot of data, I think, is more on internal processes. So in the finance space, it might be like kind of repeated measure time series data. So how much do we spend on electricity every month? Or, you know, maybe, I don't know, what does revenue look like month to month or day to day? What's it going to look like in the future? So that's kind of more salesy finance data, which I think everybody can wrap their head around. In the IT space, I think that's the data that before I started this job, I would have had no idea what that looked like. So there's a lot of data generated in bigger companies around things like IT service desk. So like if you work at Google or wherever, I don't know, a big enterprise, right? And your computer crashes, you might submit a ticket to the help desk, right? So that help desk typically has some way of aggregating and keeping track of all of the issues that are submitted and a tiering level for how critical they are. And then there's often some process for trying to tie these back to changes that might have been put in place. So that's some IT data that we've come across. And there's actually text in there as well, just like there would be in a customer feedback survey. So the methods you might apply to it might look similar. The data might be more or less useful. I'm trying to think of what else is of interest here. So from a cyber perspective, and I think this is why for cyber analytics, a lot of folks will turn to us for our expertise. So data there might be something like NetFlow logs. So folks might have logs from Palo Alto of basically things traveling across their network. So different IP packets going places. So that data, I'd say of all our data sets, is the one that really requires a serious domain expertise. And I think that's why folks might turn to us more so on that. So some of these companies have very advanced analysts, but to analyze that data, you really need to understand what it is. It's not going to make sense out of the gate. So that's where I think we've invested a lot of energy in pairing some of our, you know, most talented data scientists with some of our most talented attack and penetration analysts, which basically kind of work for these companies to find their vulnerabilities and, you know, in a safe environment, say, hey, here's where I could see a backdoor for somebody to get into your network. So their knowledge combined with an analyst's knowledge is really where you might need to go to get use of data that doesn't make as much sense as like sales data from, you know, a fashion right. company.
Oh, that's awesome.
So outside the ones where you guys have the internal domain knowledge, on cases where you've got a data set where, like, if say it's a 6 to 8 week project, are you typically in regular couple of times a week communication ad hoc with the subject matter expertise? Like, how are you rolling along to say what you're finding makes sense? You're interpreting this, all of a sudden you want to use this field. It seems like it's really useful, but, you know, the spidey sense says better check, you know. So do you have partners on the inside at the client who are accessible, readily accessible for that sort of interaction?
Yeah. So that's part of kind of the requirement of starting the project and something we do in the scoping phase. So in the scoping phase, before we even start that kind of like roughly 6 to 10 week clock, we have already identified somebody who knows the data. So we've already gotten to the point where we know what the fields are. Now, something like cybersecurity, that's definitely been a different type of investment. And there's been a lot of work that was not captured in that, you know, kind of 6 to 8, 10 week cycle, learning what something like, you know, net flow data even looks like and how to interpret it. So for some data sets, certainly.
But if it's call center data and there's 47 fields.
Yes. I need somebody on the other end of the table who's going to tell me what those are.
And you'll be able to understand it as long as they say, yeah, we do use this and it's not. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And there's definitely fields in there that you're like, oh, this looks good. And they're like, yeah, that field's
great. Wait a second. Are you trying to tell me that not all of your clients are maintaining up to date to the minute data dictionaries for all their data sources?
It's a really tough business.
I am astounded.
Yeah.
I am astounded.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of data generated at a lot of places, right? And often there might be a data dictionary, but it doesn't really make sense to an outsider. So that's definitely kind of one thing we run into. And I'd say it just kind of varies. So often there's somebody who knows the data, but you have to find them and you might have to have some conversations with them.
I feel like in the web analytics side, it's not that uncommon now for there to be people who are really into the implementation and the data collection, and they are collecting super rich sets of data. And in their minds, they're saying, these are the cool things that could be done with that data. I'm not going to do it. You know, the analysts will probably do it. I kind of wonder, do you run into sometimes the data experts, the people who maybe live and breathe the system and the process that's feeding that data, and they're just hungry to say, I've been collecting this crap for years, or this awesome gold mine for years, and we've never had anybody who can dig in. These are the 27 things you should be able to do with it.
Yeah. So I'd say that's kind of my gem of somebody on the other side of the table. And you do find that sometimes, and it's awesome because there's somebody who intimately knows this data. They've been collecting it and curating it for years. And they just, for, you know, whatever reason, kind of business as usual tasks, just have not gotten around to, you know, kind of mining the value out of it. So that is definitely your ideal person on the other end of the table.
What about the opposite though? So sometimes you have, at my old work, we had a partner who ran a model for us, a buy till you die model. And, you know, they came to present, thought the findings were so enlightening and amazing. And I was like, yeah, we kind of already knew these three things were really important to high value customers. Like, it's pretty obvious. We were very nice about it. But I mean, how would you manage that situation where you kind of go back and they're like, yeah, we already knew this, like nothing special? Or do you think that's part of the process when you're briefing in and scoping the project that you should be picking that sort of stuff up anyway?
Good question. I'd say, it's definitely, I've been in that position before. And I think typically when it's happened, if I look back, there's something differently that could have been done in the scoping process. So, and sometimes it might not be, you know, it might be a two-way street, right? Like, but typically there's something that I should have dug deeper on that I missed the boat on for whatever reason. You know, they wanted to move quicker, or I felt like I had the right stuff and I actually didn't. So that definitely, you know, can happen. I think your scoping phase is the best way to guard against it. And that's why I think the best, you know, kind of I really focus on knowing the end user and the end audience, because it's happened before where, I did have all the right conversations and ask the right questions, but it was just to the wrong people, right? I didn't realize half the other people who were going to be looking at this. So that is, definitely something I've learned along the way, is really getting the full landscape of who is going to be using what you build and talking to them, taking the time to talk to them.
Oh, that's a great insight. All right. We've been chugging along and this has been excellent. Thank you so much, Katie. Is awesome. One of the things as we start to wrap up that we love to do on the show is called The Last Call. And we like to go around, just share anything that we've seen recently that we think might be of interest to our listeners. Katie, you're our guest. Do you want to share a last call?
Actually, just today, my coworker and I were looking at this new blog post on text data, which we just talked about, and it's by Julia Silge. I'm sure I butchered her last name, Julisilge. And it's about a package in R. And basically, she is one of the bloggers that helped write the tidy text mining package in R. So she's got some great resources for mining text in R. And she kind of focuses on the Jane Austen novels. It's a great resource for cleaning text and doing topic modeling. So you could kind of get up and running pretty quickly. And nice. Her recent blog post is on basically applying a modeling framework, so GLMNet, to basically try to distinguish the some of the words within your model that did the best job at distinguishing between two classes. So this could be great for refining a model if you're trying to figure out, how do I get more out of my predictors? So that was a super technical resource I just gave you, but.
Oh, that's awesome.
I remember seeing that, thinking, I knew all this stuff.
Yes. Well, I mean, if I had a nickel for every time I wanted to like refine my text so I could do better predictors, I mean, I don't know.
I just pretty much throw everything in a convolutional neural net and I figure I'm good to go.
Wow.
Did I say that right?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think so. English is really hard though, so who knows?
Okay, Mr. Crisp. What was it? Crisp DM?
Crisp DM?
Oh. I thought that's when you have a snappy reply on Twitter, you just send to one person.
You send a crisp DM?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All right. Oh. Since I'm making fun of you, Tim, do you want to do a last call?
So I'm going to call out a last call from episode 95. For anybody who thinks, I feel like I've heard of this Katie Sasso person before, I will note that I used her presentation at the Use R conference as my last call for episode 95. It's still a really cool video on Shiny meets Electron. Turn your Shiny app into a standalone desktop app in no time. But I'm not going to count that because that would be a duplicate. I almost did it and said, wait a minute, I think I might have done that one before. So instead, I am going to go with there's a video on YouTube. So Michael, you'll like it.
Wow, I can't believe it.
that our China web optimization on Slack, the mystery person, I don't know that we know who that is. Is this called an ad fraud deep dive? What is the true impact of digital ad fraud? By Greg Miaskiewicz. It's pretty interesting because we know ad fraud happens, but it actually does a great job, I think, I learned a number of things about some of the mechanics of it, both what drives it, the different kind of reasons that ad fraud occurs, kind of the obvious reasons in hindsight why it occurs, but then also some of the techniques, and then what is kind of the arms race to try to combat it and trying to stay one step ahead. Pretty interesting, talking about, detecting mouse movements that are too straight and that sort of stuff. So it's an interesting video.
Excellent. All right, Mo, what have you got?
Okay, well, as we established on the last episode, Pavel Kapuscinski always seems to be holding my hand as I learn something new. And recently he sent me, it's by DataQuest, it's a blog, but he sent me a specific one on how to get started with Jupyter Notebook. So if you haven't had the joy of setting it up, which can be an absolute bitch, this tutorial, I was complaining about it the other day to Tim, this tutorial walks you through it. And thanks to Pavel for sharing, because it's nice and easy to follow.
Are you doing R and Python in Jupyter, or are you just doing Python stuff?
I just like the R interface. I don't want to go. I tried to move over to Jupyter Notebook, but I really.
The R Studio interface?
Yeah.
Use Markdown in R.
Oh, our notebooks, our Markdown.
I probably will get there some point, but I'm not that motivated right now, too. So we'll see.
Oh, right.
What have you got, Michael?
Well, funny you should ask. And actually, what's funny is I'm pretty sure I learned about this from a tweet from Pavel. So, Mo, you and I both got one from Pavel, interestingly enough. So it's still going on. The National Football League announced an inaugural analytics contest this year called the Big Data Bowl, where you can set up a team and you can compete with data that they'll provide. And then the top 8 entrants will be invited to the combine to present their analysis to NFL executives and players and owners. Really interesting sort of community sourcing of analytics talent in sports, which is like a massively growing analytics field. As a lifelong Cleveland Browns fan, I have mixed feelings about analytics in the NFL, given the Cleveland Browns pursued an analytics strategy and then produced one win in 2 seasons directly following that. So obviously there's a ton of opportunity to do analytics better. So you still have about a week left. Entrants have to be submitted before the end of the day on the 22nd of January. So if you're interested in that, go check it out. It's pretty interesting. I'll be looking forward to seeing what the results of those are. All right. I'm sure you've been listening, and I'm sure as you've listened, you've found Tim's comments both interesting and or asinine. No, I'm just kidding.
mostly the latter.
No, but probably raise some questions and maybe even have some comments or things like that. And we'd love to hear from you. And I'm sure Katie wouldn't mind hearing from you as well. So feel free to look any of us up. We could easily find us on the Measure Slack or on Twitter or on our website. We'd be delighted to hear from you. Pass along any questions to Katie as well. Oh, Katie, do you have a Twitter? You want to share a Twitter account really quick?
I do. I'm not super active on Twitter, but okay.
Don't expect a fast response.
Katie Sasso. I'm sorry. I tried to get better after Usar, and I just am just not great. I don't even know what my Twitter handle is right now.
It's at Katie Sasso.
Okay,
Tim knows. Great, and then obviously, just a natural question probably from our listeners. Any relation to Will Sasso, the comedian and actor?
No, I don't believe so. Yes. Well,
that's fine. It would be cool if you were like his little sister or something.
Awesome. Yeah, not so much.
Nope. Just making sure, checking all the trends. Listen, Katie, we've never had Will on the show, but we have had you on the show, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been awesome. And I'm sure I speak for my 2 co-hosts, Tim and Mo, when I tell all of you out there, keep raising the bar in analysis this year.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at analyticshour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Analytics. Oh my God. What the fuck does that even mean?
Oh wait. Actually, one quick thing can you guys see behind me what my daughter?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
What on earth is that?
It is a, I've been Matt Gershoff Vistaprint vinyl.
Like the patron saint of Faustian bargain personalization. No. He's a really smart guy. All right, are we ready? Mostly asking for Mo's benefit.
Sure.
Do a couple vocal warm-ups.
What could possibly go wrong?
Me, ma, me, ma, me, ma, mo. I mean, it's the problem is probably different, right, Mo? Because, like, if I wake up late, then I just sound like some kind of DJ with super low voice. I don't know how it'll work for you. So, we'll see.
Oh, hooray. Okay.
I kind of forget what the question was.
Yeah, I'll ask the question again, and then we'll just take that whole thing out.
Thanks, darling. I'll start again.
Hats off to kind of the.
Maybe start back the hats off too.
Yeah, so.
Because could you imagine how boring it would be for Tim to just ask Katie questions for 45 minutes?
I let her answer them, so that made it not boring, right?
That's an improvement, right?
Oh, wow. Rock, flag, and convolutional neural networks.
Love it.
Jesus, that's scary.